are going to end the era of nation building and instead focus on destroying ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism.
President Trump, during the campaign, promising a change in American strategy in Afghanistan. It's been nearly 16 years since America first invaded. President Obama ended U.S. involvement in major combat operations there 3 years ago. Since then, the Taliban has grown stronger, taking over more of the country than at any time since the war began. ISIS also has a foothold in the country now. As President Trump announces his new plan on Afghanistan today, let's look at the situation there with Rod Nordlund. He covers Afghanistan for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. So you're in Kabul?
I'm in Kabul. We just had a rocket land not too far from our house, but nobody was hurt.
Wow.
Becoming the new normal here.
Right. And so for a long time, the fighting was confined to outside the capital, but now it has encroached inward to the capital?
Not so much the fighting itself. The terrorist attacks have increased a lot in the capital to the point where more people have been killed, more civilians have been killed in Kabul this year than anywhere else in the country. That said, it's the big bombings a few times a month in a city of 5 million that caused the casualties. Most days it is fairly peaceful. Today was an exception.
Who is behind these terrorist attacks?
In Kabul, it's been mostly the Taliban, but there have been a few attacks, even in Kabul, attributed to the Islamic State or ISIS, which has made some inroads in some parts of the country. It's particularly one faction of the Taliban called the Haqqani Network that's very, very ruthless, very dangerous, and very competent, and based in Pakistan. But they are very much integrated with the rest of the Taliban.
What is life like there now and for you? And if you could just paint a picture of how it's different than how it was a few years ago.
Well, life in Kabul has become much more restricted for foreigners, especially for everybody to some extent. We don't go out recreationally nearly as much as we did because there is some risk in doing that. And I think most people in the capital are much more careful in their movements. In the rest of the country, it's becoming increasingly hard to move around. There are growing parts of the country. Some people say as much as 60% of the country under effective Taliban control. Any major highway is a risk-taking enterprise to travel on, especially for anybody like a government official or anyone with any even remote connection to a foreign entity or organization.
And are foreigners leaving?
Foreigners have left. That's kind of old news in a way. Really since 2015-16, most of them have left. For instance, Western news organizations, there's about six organizations left who have staffed this place on a regular basis. There are a lot of aid groups, but increasingly they use local staff rather than foreigners. And if they have foreigners, they very much stay to themselves. There are embassies and UN and international agencies like that do have foreigners, but not nearly in the numbers that they used to.
So if there is this increase in troops, American troops, 4,000 or so, will that substantially change what's happening there?
Well, in 2012-13, Obama, President Obama presided over a surge that added, that brought the American troops here to 100,000. Increase of, we think, probably 3,900 to 4,000. Will bring the total U.S. presence to 12,000, almost 10% of what was here before. Those 100,000 weren't able to do much except maintain the stalemate that we still see kind of limping along, and I don't think another 4,000 American troops will make that much of a difference either.
And what do Afghans want?
Well, Afghans would like us to send, 500,000 troops and, solve all their problems for them overnight and fight their war for them and everything else, but obviously that's not going to happen. I think they are happy to see some increased U.S. commitment, The current government under President Ghani has been happy to see the American special forces especially take the lead on the battlefield. You know, it's a little talked about fact, but very well known that mostly in most of the operations and military operations around the country, the American military calls the shots from, you know, from the command centers in Kabul to even, local headquarters in the field. When there's any kind of special forces operation, it's American soldiers running it. And we're going to see more of that with these additional 4,000 troops. We expect that most of them will be more special forces troops who will be out there on the ground. So we'll see an increase in American casualties, maybe an increase in some successful operations. But nobody really thinks it'll be enough to dramatically change the outcome here.
Well, more and more people are saying, what's the point of being there at all? This was promised to be a quagmire at the beginning. It's turned into a quagmire. It's the longest war the United States has ever fought. Adding 4,000 troops, as you say, probably won't do much. So what is the point of being there at all if the United States isn't going to go all in?
Well, I guess, I mean, the point of being here is that if we left, it's pretty clear that the Afghan government would collapse overnight, that all the advances that have been made by the international community here would be wiped away overnight, and particularly in the field of women's rights. It's a very imperfect picture, and there's still lots of problems with it, but women now can work, they can go to school, have some social rights that they didn't have before. I mean, they can actually get their husbands put into jail if they beat them half to death, which they didn't used to be able to do. Rape is now a crime, which it wasn't before. And, you know, those things with a Taliban victory, which would come immediately after American withdrawal, those things would be wiped out completely.
So the alternative is this stalemate?
Yeah, maybe just this sort of endless kind of war without end. I don't know. I don't have any answers myself, but I can't see any other solution. I mean, when you talk to almost everybody, American diplomats, military leaders, even Afghan officials, everyone says the same thing, that there is no victory here. The only solution to this is a negotiated peace settlement. But the problem is that there's no appetite on the Taliban side for a peace settlement. They think they're going to win, and they're determined to win, and they're not willing to make peace. You know, all the efforts in that direction in the past couple of years have been spectacular failures, and at the moment there's hardly anything going on in terms of peace initiatives.
And given that they do control, as you say, 60% of the country, what would entice them to sit down and negotiate?
I think various formulas. I think, in the past, there has been some uptake from the Taliban on ideas like giving them some ministries, obviously not the Ministry of Women's Affairs, letting them come into the government, maybe even giving them, you know, effective control of certain territories where their followers are a very clear predominant majority, such as in parts of the east and the south. The various formulas that some of their people haven't in the past expressed interest in pursuing. It all comes down to the issue of women, though. There are some women's issues they're just not going to give in on. They say they'll allow women to go to school, but the idea of women in ministries and women running things is just anathema to them, and it's hard to imagine them giving in on that. So they will, and then they will also want to see an amendment or amendments to the Constitution that give a stronger place to Sharia law, and that is a red flag to liberals here and to women's rights activists who just see that as a means of oppressing women further.
Rod Nordland, reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan, for The New York Times. Coming Coming up, how the ACLU is changing its strategy when it comes to defending neo-Nazis. Legal expert Jessica Levinson will be here to discuss that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. More fallout from Charlottesville now. L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer says he wants the city to further restrict, even deny, rally permits to hate groups like the Nazis and the KKK. And in response to the clashes in Charlottesville, the ACLU says it will no longer represent hate groups that want to march with guns. The ACLU also plans to weigh the risk of violence more carefully when evaluating potential clients. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about all of this. It's Monday, our regular Legal Eagle on Mondays. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, so what kind of internal push and pull is the ACLU going through right now?
Well, the ACLU has basically said this is a clarification of their longstanding perspective. But what happened is the ACLU is dedicated to defending people who have civil rights claims, whether or not we like them or we think they're popular. And that's what they said is exactly the point. The ACLU famously has defended the rights of neo-Nazis to march in a town in Illinois that was heavily populated by Holocaust survivors. And they've said, we live in a society where it's most important that we uphold First Amendment rights, that this isn't about upholding the rights of the people we like. It's more important for everybody to uphold the rights of even those we find completely distasteful, like
neo-Nazis. Okay, so now why are they saying, well, maybe we need to reevaluate this?
Well, after Charlottesville, a lot of members of the leadership of the ACLU, I think, said, look, we defended the organizers. We went to court and we said, you can't try and move the rally to another place. That would suppress their speech. And then someone died as a result of the protests and counter-protests in Charlottesville. And the ACLU has said, we're going to look more carefully at the risk of violence that might be incited by the protesters. We're going to say there's also health and safety concerns that we have to consider. And we're going to say we don't have to pick plaintiffs who, for instance, want to carry guns, that if you are an organizer and you're a white supremacist, we'll still support you in terms of we'll support your First Amendment rights. But if you want to carry guns, we don't need to take you as a plaintiff.
What about their Second Amendment rights?
This is a broader and interesting clash between the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. But we're talking about, for the ACLU, these First Amendment rights to protest. We're not talking about infringement on their Second Amendment rights just by virtue of saying you don't get a permit for this rally or protest.
Let's talk about what Mike Feuer wants to do. And so this is a similar kind of issue that he's trying to figure out, whether or not these groups will incite violence and whether or not that would then be legally permissible to deny them a permit to march.
That's exactly right. I think Mike Feuer and the ACLU, and Mike Feuer has been involved with the ACLU, are struggling with exactly the same thing. We don't want to do something we say in law school, don't let bad facts make bad laws. So just because we don't want white supremacists and neo-Nazis to march, let's not change the jurisprudence and whittle down the First Amendment that protects all of us. But Mike Feuer is saying, look, we can do things like Boston has done when it gives permits, which is to say, but don't carry bats, don't carry sticks, don't carry backpacks. So what we're worried about in terms of governments denying or limiting these permits for free speech is we're worried about them saying two things. One, you don't get the permit because we don't like you, or you don't get the permit because we don't like what you say. And those are the two types of content-based restrictions. And that's what the First Amendment is most worried about, because then the government is choosing, we like you or we like your group, but we don't like you. And that's quintessentially what the First Amendment is most concerned about, is the government picks and chooses winners and losers. Now, Mike Feuer has said, look, we uphold the First Amendment in Los Angeles. We're concerned about everybody's free expression. But I also have the obligation to make sure that people are safe from violence, that there are a number of reasons that we can restrict permits. And these are called time, place, and manner restrictions. Basically, you can hold a rally in LA, but not if it's in the middle of the 10 freeway in the morning and nobody mm-hmm. can get to work.
Yeah.
As long as that restriction counts for everybody, whether it be Planned Parenthood or a white supremacist group, it applies across the board to everyone.
But can he deny a permit outright and say, sorry, no KKK marches?
No, he has to look at whether or not it looks like not just that there might be a potential for violence. That's, I think, too speculative. But whether or not the organizers have tried to incite violence. So they're going to be looking at things. And this is the First Amendment. It's messy. There's no bright line rules. He's going to be looking at things like the credibility of the organizers. What have the organizers said in the past? What are they saying on Facebook? Again, it's not, could this dissolve into messiness? Could there be a kerfuffle? It has to be more specific to pass the test of you don't get to exercise your free speech rights in LA.
Mm. I can see how it would be a gray area, though, when looking at past incidents, perhaps there are violence at previous marches or whatever they're saying online, because you could argue, well, there were past scuffles because there were counter-protesters there. We were marching peacefully. Or you could say, well, what's wrong with expressing a very kind of a violent belief? Like if you said online, I want to kill you, it doesn't mean you're going to. It's just your freedom of expression. So how is he going to weigh those kinds of questions? I guess it's just going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Well, so you hit on one of the most, I think, thorny areas in First Amendment law. And there isn't a straightforward legal answer of this is exactly where the line is. There isn't. As you said, it's based on facts and circumstances. That can be problematic in the First Amendment because we want people to not feel like they might potentially be chilled in their speech. On the other hand, we want people to feel that they're safe and that they're not going to be injured or they're not going to be killed. And so it's going to be a difficult determination of looking at basically how scary and how bad do we think this is going to be?
Well, it's interesting that now is when this is all coming out. I mean, obviously, Charlottesville was the instigating moment, but there have been cases of violence with these marches in the past, and people have died, and this hasn't really come to the fore as it has now.
I think this happens in so many areas of the law and frankly in life, where we don't have this kind of blip that forces us to confront not only where our society feels the line should be drawn, but where the jurisprudential line is going to be drawn. And these are going to be difficult cases for judges to look at, because I think that judges by nature are small c conservative, and they want to be able to say they're upholding First Amendment rights. And it's awkward for any member of the government, including judges, to say, I'm sorry, you don't get to exercise your freedom of expression.
Well, I mean, you also hit on another perhaps more pedestrian angle to this, and that is a fear of a lawsuit. Does the city fear that should someone get injured by one of these protesters, they'll sue the city for granting a permit?
Not speaking for the city attorney's office, yes, I'm sure that there are a number of competing concerns for any city attorney. So one, I mean, I'm not saying that anybody's motivated by this alone, but city attorneys are largely elected individuals. So they're also looking at what best represents their constituents, what may best play in the next election for either city attorney or another office. I mean, we can all imagine what the lawsuit would say. Why did you give these people a permit? It was clear that violence was going to be incited. Now XYZ happened to me and I would like my $30 million. So I think there are a lot of competing concerns for not just Mike Fuhrer, but for other city attorneys to look at. Nobody wants bad publicity on either side. Nobody wants to be the city attorney who hates the First Amendment or the city attorney who, I mean, God forbid, is having to mourn someone at a funeral. These are very difficult, delicate questions.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, have we just become New Jersey? Why the trash in some LA neighborhoods is not getting picked up? And actor Sterling K. Brown is here. He used to joke that there could be only one black actor working in Hollywood at a time, but he says it's a lot different now.
There's no monolithic black experience that's being depicted. Like, there's enough variety to show that, like, oh, different black people live differently within this country. And we grow through exposure.
Sterling K. Brown, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles has a new plan to cut back on the amount of trash going to landfills and the number of garbage trucks chugging down city streets. Businesses and apartment building owners used to be able to choose which trash collection company to hire. Now they'll have just one choice. The city says everything will run better if one company does all the work in a given area. But so far, the plan has led to uncollected garbage and unhappy building owners who have been hit with increased fees. For more on the city's new program, we have Dave Zanheiser on. He covers LA City Hall for the LA Times. Hi.
Hello.
All right. This seems like your basic issue, you know, that the city needs to get right, picking up garbage. So how much garbage is just sitting around right now waiting to get collected?
You know, about a couple weeks ago, the city sanitation department was saying that they were getting hit with about 90 calls a day about uncollected trash. I don't have the latest numbers, but part of the thing that's going on is they're phasing this in, right? And so most recently, I think the hot spot was really the West Side. The most complaints I'm getting right now are actually about price, people who are either seeing their bill for the first time or they're seeing an estimate. Basically, what's happened is, you know, the city is switching over about 80,000 customers. So that's condo buildings, businesses, apartment buildings that are 5 units and up. And so you've got all these haulers who are like learning new routes. They have to figure out how to open a garage gate if it's a locked garage. And the city is saying, well, since they're moving over tens of thousands of customers, the number of complaints is actually rather small, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're the person whose trash isn't being picked up, you might not feel that way. But they say this is all going to be worked out over the long term as the transition is completed. What's not clear right now is how they're going to work out some of the cost issues, which I think are probably a little trickier.
Yeah. So I read that in the intro that some owners are getting hit with these increased fees. What are those increased fees for?
Well, so for example, you know, again, remember, these are folks who before they could call their hauler, any hauler, negotiate a price and negotiate a level of service. Now there is a citywide pricing system, and that new system has some charges that customers have never seen before. So for example, a trash hauler, if you're in a building with a locked gate, they can charge an access fee, which is basically to use the clicker to open the gate. They can charge every time they open that gate, right? They also are now charging for moving a bin a certain distance to the street where it's emptied. So if they pull a bin out 100 feet, they can charge one amount. If they pull a bin more than 200 feet, so let's say you're in a big complex where the bin is in the back of the property, if they pull it 200 feet, it's an even bigger fee. So, you know, I've had people tell me their buildings are getting hit with like $86 a month in clicker fees, or like $300 to $600 a month in distance fees to pull the bin, something they never paid for before, and that's on top of the regular rate.
So if they're not paying, then the companies say, okay, we're not going to pick up your trash, and that's why there's trash on the streets?
Well, no. I mean, I think the more the trash on the street is the issue of haulers not quite figuring out yet how they're supposed to pick up the trash and what day they're supposed to go and how they're supposed to get inside a building.
Okay. All right. Let's bring in Councilmember Paul Koretz. He represents the West Side, and he voted for this plan. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So what have you been hearing from your residents and business owners about
this? Well, we've gotten a fair number of complaints. I think we're up to about 400. Some of them were pickup complaints. We have responded to those quickly, and where the hauler hasn't been able to access quickly, we've had sanitation do immediate pickups. So we are trying to get that under control in the short term. A lot of that problem relates to the previous haulers not providing information. And so a truck would come, they'd have no idea how to access the trash. Those issues, once they're handled once, they're handled. But it'll take a while to work our way through all of those.
Yeah. So what problem are you trying to solve here?
Well, that's one, and that I believe will be solved.
I mean, in general, with this new plan.
The other problem is cost. Some of it is the fact that people don't realize we're paying for a completely different system, and one where we dramatically reduce pollution, we dramatically reduce the amount going into landfills and increase recycling. We remarkably reduce traffic, so instead of 35 companies going to a customer here and a customer there, there's only one in a zone. So we reduce noise, and frankly, workers were working in terrible conditions, many of them not even getting paid minimum wage, many of them working in dangerous conditions. So all these things are being addressed, and companies are being required to buy all new trucks that are not polluting. And so you add that all up, it adds a certain amount of cost. Mm. But there's a lot that's gained by it. There are some folks that have actually had their costs go down, but some of them have had it go up. And partly what they need to do is figure out how they can divert more of their trash to the recycling bins, because those don't cost. The cost is in the waste pickup. And so they can take advantage of a waste characterization assessment, so they can be helped to move more in the recycling direction, and that can dramatically reduce their costs. There have also been problems with the configuration of the buildings, so they may not have room for additional recycling bins. So I know some of the companies have looked at creating different size bins to make that work. I've just suggested to one of them that they look at taller recycling bins so that where they can't add square footage, they can move up 2 or 3 feet and squeeze in more recycling. So I think there's a lot of creative things they can still do to improve the process. There's a lot they can do to work through the logistical problems, which I think will generally be one time at a site. And I'm hopeful that in 3-4 months, the complaints that we're getting taper off and the problems are largely resolved.
And quickly, are you worried, though, that when you have one company servicing one area, you are, and without competition, you're setting up an environment for some kind of abuse of the system, maybe overcharging or some kind of criminality?
Well, they can't overcharge because the charges are set by the city. So there are ceilings for those. Where I think the costs will be saved will be in increasing recycling. And so I think doing the outreach and making sure we help all our customers learn to recycle more is what's going to save them a certain amount of money. I've also asked the sanitation department to hold workshops to help people figure out how they can reduce their costs.
Okay. L.A. City Councilman Paul Koretz. We also heard from Dave Zonheiser covering L.A. City Hall for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we are going to hear from actor Sterling K. Brown. He's here to talk about his Emmy nomination for This Is Us and playing Christopher Darden in the O.J. Simpson miniseries. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The actor Sterling K. Brown has had a pretty good year and a half so far. He won an Emmy for his portrayal of Christopher Darden in The People vs. O.J. Simpson, and he's nominated again for his role as Randall Pearson on the NBC show This Is Us. He also starred in Susan Laurie Park's play Father Comes Home from the Wars at the Taper last year. And Sterling K. Brown joins me in the studio. Hi.
How you doing, Madeline?
I'm doing really well. Okay, so before we get to This Is Us, let's go back in time a little bit to O.J.
Okay.
Way back to the real O.J. trial.
Okay.
And so you were in school at the time at Stanford?
That is correct.
Do you remember how you reacted at that time to the trial?
Oh, most definitely. So I lived in a dorm on campus called Ujamaa House, which is one of the four ethnic theme houses on campus, the African-American theme house, where the percentage of the dorm is 50% African-American, 50% other, right? So when the verdict came down, we were all packed into this TV lounge, and it was not guilty. The black students just were euphoric. Like, we flipped out. We were high-fiving. We were going crazy. Like, it was, like, partying like it was 1999. The other students who were looking at us were in shock. They're like, why are you guys celebrating? This man may very well have killed these two people, and he's going to walk free. And it's so interesting that it wasn't in the forefront of our minds that Ron and Nicole had died. What was in the forefront of our minds was that the criminal justice system was finally working for someone who looked like us, right? And that was the cause for celebration. Like, when I think about it, I don't know if I felt as if OJ was innocent or guilty. It was almost secondary to the fact that this justice system could actually work for me and not always against me, because we have lots of stories of it working against us, right?
Yeah. And so then you play the prosecutor.
This is true.
Christopher Darden.
Yeah.
So when you were preparing for that role, did you think back to how you felt back then in real life at Stanford?
Absolutely. And it was an opportunity for me to release so much judgment that I had around Christopher Darden and his role in the trial and sort of the image that I had of him of being a crab in a barrel trying to pull down another black man, right? Like, why would you try to do this to this brother? Now when I get a chance to 20 years later to step into his shoes and to see the conundrum that he placed himself in, being the black face of the prosecution, knowing just how unpopular it was, but believing in the evidence and that the evidence led him to believe that O.J. was guilty of a double homicide.
She is the racist, not me. But that is what you're suggesting.
Hey, I suggest not.
No, yes, you did.
Don't put words in my mouth.
And that has created a lot of problems for myself and for my family. You continually make statements about me and race, Mr. Cochran.
The level of sacrifice that he made in terms of he had a brother who died from AIDS, who was withering away in the course of that trial that he didn't get a chance to visit as much as he would have liked. He would receive death threats. He was called everything under the book, Uncle Tom, sellout, race traitor, etc. And for someone who loved and loves being black so much, I think he was wounded to the core. And without trying to overstep my bounds, outside of the victims' families, I think that the wounds of this trial are still most visibly shown on him than anybody else. Mm-hmm.
So then playing him,
yeah,
were you able to revisit your reaction and amend it in any way? Did you want to, or do you still believe you had a valid and justified reaction back in the 90s when the real verdict was announced?
Everybody's reaction is valid because everybody's reaction is shaped by their experience in this country up to that point, right? What I appreciate about being able to revisit it from the prosecution's perspective is that I have a greater level of empathy for the people who were shocked. Like, I understand why they were shocked and in some cases appalled, because two people had lost their lives. And I hope that the people who were appalled in watching the show and hopefully in watching the documentary as well could understand the celebration of the people who rejoiced over the acquittal. Because there's no sort of objective reality in terms of how we experience this country and the way our relationships to law enforcement and to this institution which is supposed to protect and serve. I think especially over the past 2-3 years, where we have this growing level of ocular proof that that is not always the case for Black people in this country, I think people are understanding a bit more. Something that they thought was the Rodney King beating was sort of an anomaly.
Hmm. And you grew up in St. Louis.
I did.
Which is, you know, Ferguson is a suburb of St. Louis.
It is indeed.
So did you have direct experience with what you're talking about?
I had experience, I mean, probably less than most, but I've had times in which I would be sitting in my father's car, who had passed away. He had a Fleetwood Cadillac, and I would be in a friend's neighborhood who would be more affluent than myself, and I'd have police roll up on me. As I was doing homework, like, what are you doing here? I was like, I'm waiting for my friend. And they're like, well, I don't know if you can wait here or not. Like, I've had that happen on more than a few occasions. I've been followed in stores by security guards just a little bit closer. You know, you feel eyes, you know, and you're told oftentimes as a young man by your family that people are watching. You know, the dialogue within a Black family is that you have to be twice as good to make it just as far.
Does that hold true, do you think, in your profession in acting for you?
No, I don't. I think acting is kind of a bit of an equalizer and that it's such a subjective thing anyway. When an audience is watching you, if they feel as if they're watching someone being truthful and in the moment, then I think that can supersede a lot of stuff. But where it does become difficult is the level of opportunities that you have to show the breadth of human experience for a Black person.
Do you think that you have been given that lately?
Lately.
It's been a long time. It's starting to happen.
Because for a long time, you stand on the outside watching other people get opportunities, and you feel for a while that there can be only one. Like a lot of New York actors.
One Black actor.
Exactly. For a long time in New York, buddies of mine, we would talk about the career and wonderful and earned career of Anthony Mackie. And it seems like Mackie would just go from like show to show, movie to movie to movie to movie. I'm like, man, can I get some of this? Can I get some of this love, right? And then finally there would be someone like Chadwick who would break through.
Chadwick Boseman.
Yeah. He'd be like, oh, snap, okay. There's two. That's pretty cool, right? And then David Oyelowo was sort of cracking that. It's like, oh, so it seems as if the landscape is evolving in such a way that Hollywood recognizes that there is a marketplace for diverse stories, for characters of color that are nuanced and three-dimensional. And so I feel as if now those opportunities are starting to come my way as well.
And it seems that
Knocking on wood.
Well, right. So there's your character on This Is Us. Mm-hmm. There is Atlanta. There's Black-ish.
Yes.
There's Insecure. There seems to be a lot of really meaty roles
for
Black actors now.
Yeah. They're coming through.
Yeah.
Underground, Queen Sugar. Right. You know, like they're coming through. And what I love about it is that the specificity of the voices, there's no monolithic Black experience that's being depicted. Like, there's enough variety to show that, like, oh, different Black people live differently within this country. And we grow through exposure, right? So I feel like in very sort of homogenous regions of the country where their interaction with African Americans could be minimal, if folks are interested, they have an opportunity to see a very diverse landscape of African Americans' experience in this country. And we grow through experience, you know?
Do you ever get weary of having to talk about race while you're acting? In other words, that it is so in the forefront?
No.
Like in This Is Us, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there's all this tension between you. You play, for people who don't know, you play the black adopted son in a white family.
Right.
And so race is always front and center.
Absolutely.
Do you ever get tired of that, that has to be front and center, that it just can't be you guys are just living and not talking about it?
I don't. And I think I don't get tired of it because it's sort of the way I live my life. And I feel to a certain extent, anyone who's not a white male in this country has to have a very acute understanding of their role and the role of the mainstream, so that women have to understand what it's like to live in a man's world. Gay people have to understand what it's like to live in a very sort of hetero, you know, centric world. Black people have to understand what it's like to live in a white world. So the prism through which I experience America is very much my own. And when I'm allowed to speak about it openly and not have to sort of be like, well, I don't want to rock the boat, or I don't want to always bring up race or anything, but, you know, this is the way in which I see the world. When I see our president, you know, say some of the things that he says, and when I think about our former president, if he would be given the same amount of latitude to do similar things, I'm like, no. So it's how I see most things. And it's not, it doesn't define everything. Like, you know, I recognize the humanity and commonality of all of us, but I also recognize that our experiences are shaped by race, by sex, by sexual orientation. And if we try to ignore those things, then we're sort of erasing the experience of those groups. So we got to talk about it.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Sterling K. Brown. He is nominated for an Emmy for his role in This Is Us. I want to play a clip of tape of one of the key storylines in This Is Us, is you, your character, trying to find your father, finding your father, trying to reconcile the fact that he abandoned you. He was a heroin addict. Anyway, I just want to play a clip of tape of the two of you.
A little scared. You're okay, Dad. You're good. Just breathe. Come on now, breathe with me.
So that's you your father's hospital bed.
Yeah.
And he's dying of cancer. I know that your father died when you were young.
Yes.
Of...
Died from a heart attack. Yeah. He was diagnosed with sugar diabetes the day that he died, but like too many black men didn't find that out till the day that he died because he refused to go to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so when you were playing that scene, were you drawing on your own experience?
Sure.
Your own memories of your father and your relationship with him?
Absolutely. I mean, I think stories about fathers and sons have always sort of resonated with me at a deeper level because of the sense of lack that I've had from losing Sterling Brown Jr. at age 10. And so the opportunity to sort of revisit that as Randall with William was kind of healing, because I didn't get a chance to be there when my dad died because they thought I was too young, so I had to stay at home. And I remember laying on the love seat. I was asleep. And my brother came up the stairs and he said, Kelby. I said, what? And he said, your daddy's dead. I said, okay. And he said, Kelby, did you hear me? I said, your daddy's dead. I said, I heard you. Can I go back to sleep? And he said, yeah. And I knew he was gonna die. I knew earlier that day when I woke up for school. And I walk into the kitchen for breakfast, and my mom was on the phone, and she was crying, and she was on the phone 911 trying to call the paramedics. And she said, go put some clothes on your daddy. So I walk back towards their bedroom, and my dad is laid naked on the bed, and his body's stiff. Like, his arms and legs are just straight. And I go to get underwear for him, and I try to pull his underwear up over his feet and everything. And it's weird for me. It's weird for him. And he's like, go get your mama. He says, go get your mama. Can't move too much. Go get your mama. I go back to the kitchen. I said, Ma, he wants you to do it. And she's like, why can't you just do anything I say? Like, she's losing it. You can tell. And like, nobody's mad. I'm not mad. Like, I get, like, something out of the normal is transpiring here. She goes, puts clothes on him. The paramedics get there, and they come up the stairs with the gurney. They load him onto the gurney. They're carrying him down the steps. And I believe this is true. I believe this is true. The nature of memory changes over time. So it's been 30 years. But as they were carrying him through the door, he looked directly at me and he winked. That was the last time I saw him. And the next day, I was eager to just move on. It's like, all right, I'm going to go back to school. Mom's like, no, you're not going to school. And that's when the people bring the food and they come visit and they sit with her. And my mom wasn't a crier. And this is the first time I remember seeing, like, my mother cry. And I had this feeling of, like, well, I'm not going to cry because we can't all break down right now. Like, that was the feeling I had.
And you were 10 years old.
And I was 10 years old. And it was a while before I allowed the grief to really sort of hit me and to mourn in a full way, because I was busy trying to be the man of the house for a while. And it wasn't probably either just before or right when I started going by my first name that those things were sort of all hooked into each other. Grieving him and also wanting to hear his name. You know what I mean?
Because that's your father's name.
Yeah.
Sterling.
Yeah, I'm Sterling Kelby Brown. He's Sterling Brown Jr. So, yeah.
And how old were you when you did that?
16. I was 16. 16, and I can remember there's an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch because I had a very good football game against our rival, and it says, Brown is Sterling for MICDS, which is the name of my school. And it was really nice to see his name in print. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that memory with
us. No problem. No problem.
And thank you so much for coming in today.
You got it, Madeline.
It was great to meet you.
It was my pleasure.
That's Sterling K. Brown. He is one of the stars of This Is Us, for which he's nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. Christian Bordahl is back from a very long vacation. Some of you are gone forever.
But I'm back now on Eclipse Day. How does the moon cut his hair, Madeline Brand?
I didn't know he had hair.
Eclipse it.
Eclipse it, get it?
Yes.
Wow, this vacation has done wonders for your sense of humor.
It has. Yes. Well, the Twitterverse flooded, of course, with pictures of the moon blotting out the sun. A few unhappy pictures of just clouds. I saw a video of our president apparently doing what you weren't supposed to do.
Looking right into the sun.
Mm-hmm. Without the glasses. My favorite tweet came from Alexandra Rose. It's a pro tip. She says, buy your eclipse glasses tomorrow because they're going to be on sale. It was pretty cool, though. I mean, even the partial eclipse that we could see here was pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could save those glasses for 7 years from now.
And I talked to a friend who was in the path of totality. He said it was mind-blowing. I would like to have seen that.
I know. Well,
there's always April 2024. That's the next one.
Okay. Well, get your glasses. Keep your glasses.
Yeah. They'll be on sale.
Thanks, Christian Bordahl. Maybe keep the jokes, too.
Yes, okay.
All right. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.